Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to start with Senate Bill 556. And I'm going to ask Josh to give us an overview. And Bill, if you'll come on up, Senator Hansel. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 556 creates the offense of driving with a dog in the driver's lap, punishes as a Class D violation with a presumptive fine of $110.
So, Senator Hansel, you were chosen to go first since you're the only person that signed up to your testimony. And I figured you had other things you needed to probably do before we got into the other longer discussions.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that very much. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator from District 29. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 556. Senate Bill 556 came about from listening to a friend share her concerns about a potentially dangerous situation we allow some Oregon drivers to do, namely drive with dogs or pets in their laps. My friend said we are doing so much in Oregon to combat distracted driving, and while we allow this type of distraction to occur, it didn't make sense to her. I agreed, and Senate Bill 556 attempts to address this form of distracted driving. Oregon already has statutes which address distracted driving, no texting or talking with handhelds, to name a couple. In doing research on this bill, my office found other states which have statutes that deal with driving with pets in your lap. And according to NCSL, more and more states are moving in this direction each year. Most deal with this particular problem under distracted driving. However, Hawaii specifically forbids, and I quote, "While operating a motor vehicle, no person shall hold in a person's lap or allow to be in the driver's immediate area any person, animal, or object which interferes with the driver's control over the driving mechanism of the vehicle," end of quote. In addition to the safety of the driver and other persons on the road, this bill would also protect the pet, usually a dog. A dog can be seriously injured or killed in a car crash if unrestrained. They can be thrown through or out of the car, or perhaps more likely be seriously injured or killed with the deployment of an airbag being crushed to death against the body of the driver. Senate Bill 556 seeks to prevent injury to both driver and pet. Senate Bill 556 would prohibit drivers from driving with dogs in their laps. Those who do can be fined up to $250. The offense would be considered a Class D traffic violation. This bill does not prevent pets from being in the vehicle. It merely prohibits drivers from driving with them on their lap. It just makes sense to me. Driving with any live animal on your lap is a distraction which puts the pet, the driver, other passengers, and other drivers at significant risk for an accident that would otherwise be preventable. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 556 and for hearing this bill. I'm more than happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Question, Senator Dimbrough first.
Thank you. Senator Hansel, so why do you hate dogs?
Actually, I love dogs, and that's why I'm trying to protect them.
Yes, no, I'm very supportive of this. But I do wonder why not include other animals? Just limit it to dogs?
I would be more than happy to an amendment to include any pets or animals. We focus because that seems to be the most prevalent. But I'm perfectly amenable to whatever. It's the distraction, whatever it's right on the lap.
Senator Manning.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you and happy Monday to you. And, again, why do you hate dogs? mentioned on your testimony that I think you had said something about a fine up to $250. Here it says that I have $110. I just want to just kind of clarify that.
That's a presumptive fine.
Presumptive.
That's what the officer would be writing on the ticket that you would receive, but the range goes up to 250.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So the only other question I would have, Bill, is regarding careless driving. Why you don't think careless driving, which we have on the books now, wouldn't apply to this situation?
I think it doesn't appear to be enforced. It's happening. I just want to be specific about it. Okay. Either people aren't aware of it or whatever. It just, if there are laws that would cover it, then that's one thing. But it doesn't appear to be happening, Chair. So that's the reason for the bill.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 556? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing. We have Senator Taylor here, so that's going to be Senate Bill 248, and we'll open up the public hearing on that. And Josh, if you can give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 248 authorizes the use of a pseudonym, initials, or other signifier on an indictment in lieu of the actual name of victim or witnesses, requires that a separate document containing those names be simultaneously filed under seal and provided to the defendant within 10 days unless there is good cause for providing it at a later time. For purposes of the public hearing today, there's a -7 amendment before you. The -7 amendment limits the application of the bill to cases in which a sex crime is charged. The amendment requires the defendant to be provided a copy of the simultaneously filed list at the time of arraignment, unless there is good cause for providing it at a later time. And finally, the -7 amendment provides that the separately filed document is not a public record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. Thank you for having me back again and for a hearing on Senate Bill 248. Again, this bill came out of the sex trafficking work group that I co-chair with Representative John Huffman, who unfortunately could not be here this morning. This bill came from one of our work group meetings where the District Attorney JR here shared this concept and was quickly supported by victim advocates in the room. Senate Bill 248, including the -7 amendment, which is before you today on OLIS, seeks to protect victims and witnesses in grand jury proceedings in cases that involve a sex crime. Currently, victim and witness names are publicly available on the grand jury affidavit, and sometimes those individuals experience threats or intimidation as a result of testifying against a perpetrator. This bill allows the state to assign a nickname or a pseudonym to be placed on public documents when identifying a vulnerable victim or witness. Committee counsel effectively described the -7 amendment. The legislative counsel is available to walk through the section by section of the bill as well as answer any questions. As an overview, however, the -7 amendment responds to certain stakeholder feedback we received. For example, the -7 amendment removes the 10-day time limit to share the identifying information with the defense so they can appropriately defend their clients. Secondly, narrowing the scope of the bill to sex crimes alone helps to address the purpose of the bill, which is to assist survivors of sexual assault, including sex crimes, and make certain that the use of synonym is not applied inappropriately, but only to particularly sensitive crimes. Thirdly, we additionally removed the language about the document being, quote unquote, under seal, as that presented barriers to the Judicial Department to carry out administrative duties such as processing remuneration. We instead made certain that the language made clear that the information about the victim or witness is not considered a public record, which again, Legislative Council can speak to more specifically. I want to thank the stakeholders who reached out to me and to Representative Huffman to share their items of concern and with the original language that influenced the amendment you have before you today. I appreciate you taking the time to hear Senate Bill 248 along with the -7 amendment and hope to have your support on the bill.
Thank you. JR?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is J.R. Ujifusa. I'm a deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. I'm also representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I've been a district attorney for 12 years, and in my experience, this bill is for victim safety and victims' rights. The indictment is a main tool, especially in sex crimes, and the sex crimes that I deal with, trafficking crimes in particular, for intimidating, tampering, threatening, and even violence against victims. An indictment under the law right now requires that any individual who testifies in front of grand jury name must appear on the indictment or they are not allowed to testify in trial. This bill would provide the exact same information to the defense that they had received as they do now. All that this bill would do would protect victims' names from public record from associates and family members in case after case that I see where family members and associates intimidate victims and try to prevent them from coming to court, knowing that their testimony is key in especially sexual assault crimes. This is similar to federal practice in which it is done now. It is constitutional, and it's similar to many other states in which they have almost the exact same bill on record in their laws. Grand jury is not affected in any way. This does not change anything in grand jury, and since the names of the individuals who are represented on the indictment are provided simultaneously with the indictment at arraignment, the defense will have, as I said earlier, the same information. Because it is confidential and not under seal, this is just to protect what we are looking for, which is to protect names of victims from being public record to be intimidated with. The good cause exception in this bill also allows, if there is an error in spelling, a problem with the filing, that a sexual assault crime will not be dismissed or that the case will not be able to go forward based on some small mistake that is made. And practicing in 12 years, unfortunately, those mistakes are made as they pass through different hands. Now, of course, these are only for sex crimes, which means that the concerns that I think you may hear later from the media about wanting to know the names of victims, in my experience, victims' names and sex crimes are not reported in the paper, not reported in the news, because of respect and the ethics involved in giving the names of victims. Now, this applies to both minors and adult victims of sex crimes that are already listed under the ORSs. I'm happy to respond to any questions you may have or questions after other testimony about the applicability of this bill and also how this would prevent and keep victims safe.
So I'm going to ask Nita Bellis to please come on up since you're also a proponent. We'll take your testimony, then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Senator Prusansky, for allowing me to testify on this bill. My name's Nita Bells. I'm the executive director of a national anti-human trafficking nonprofit in our backyard based in Bend, Oregon. I drove over this morning to testify because I believe this bill has the potential to improve the way our judicial system works in prosecuting cases involving human trafficking. The fear of victims testifying against their traffickers cannot be over-exaggerated. They, their mothers, fathers, children, and pets have been threatened, and the traffickers have carried out enough threats against them in the past to make believers out of them. For these victims and survivors to be protected as much as possible, it will not only encourage them to testify, but will, in truth, protect them and their loved ones from some retaliation or even death. We must bring these violent criminals to justice, and oftentimes it is impossible to do that without a victim. I work with victims and survivors every day, and these are some of the things that they have been done to them or their families. Some of them would step up and say, I'm going to do it for myself, but then they have things happen to their loved ones because that's one of the ways that traffickers manipulate. I've seen children's pets killed and laid at the doorstep of the children's home where the victim is a mother. I've seen threats to the victim's mother, threat to burn her house down, and the victim knows that that perpetrator has burnt down other homes. The safety of the victim is paramount. They know they are fortunate to be alive every day, and testifying is a major threat to their life and the life of others. Perpetrators will not be brought to justice without a witness. We must protect those who have been abused in the most horrific ways right here in our backyard and help them get free from being trapped in this horrific crime. I would urge you to move forward on this bill, and I thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? JR, the only question I have is based on your testimony, you're saying that other states have similar legislation. Could you please provide us with a list of those states that do?
Sure. I don't have that list right now, but I'm happy to provide it with you. Yes, yeah. Very similar bills with sex crimes allowing states to use pseudonyms or for the victims on the indictment.
Yeah, if you'll give us that list to staff, we'd appreciate that. All right, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and excuse y'all. Thank you for being here. Our next panel on 248 is going to include Gail Meyer, Sean McCray, and Jim Gibson.
Shall I proceed? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we do oppose Senate Bill 248 for the following reasons. There's been a breadth and a span of discussion already. If you look at the original bill, which was very broad in scope, proposed by the Multnomah County DAs here, but very broad in scope, not limited to any crime, but all crimes. We can't help but be concerned about the ultimate long-term goal, should some exceptions be acknowledged, at least initially, in this bill. There was discussion about sex trafficking and the dangers with sex trafficking, but of course the Dash 7 is not limited to trafficking. It's now been limited to sex crimes only. And further, with respect to the testimony that you just heard about concerns for victims who are identified with intimidation or some kind of reprisal, that the testimony wasn't tethered to information that was contained within a publicly filed indictment. Hopefully, proponents are still prepared to give the defense immediate access to the police reports. The police reports will name the victim and the witnesses. And so the testimony that you just heard in terms of all these concerns, I did not hear them tethered to the fact that there was some problem that arose from the fact that there was a publicly filed indictment. I'd like to break down my comments between the victims, the grand jury witnesses, and then also access provided to the defense lawyer. What I think distinguishes the Dash 7 amendment from some of the other state laws that I at least saw was that there's no judicial supervision or oversight. This bill would allow the prosecution to initiate this abbreviated reference on its own initiative with no ability from a court to make a determination as to whether or not there's need, or to make a determination later that it ought to be unfiled or, you know, disclosed. The defense is going to be significantly impacted by not having the ability to know who is the victim, even on a separately filed case, or who were the witnesses, even on a separately filed case. Sometimes people in the case at issue have made repeated allegations, and those repeated allegations become the core of the defense. So if I might relate a story, it is very germane to this bill. In the early 80s, I represented a black man in his 30s on parole for having committed property crimes, standing at a bus stop. Police officer comes up to him and says, there's a 13-year-old girl across the street. She says that you kidnapped and raped her 6 weeks ago. And he said, I don't know what I was doing 6 weeks ago. I just simply know I wasn't raping anyone. And the police officer took the girl over to get a better look at him. She says, no, I'm pretty sure he's it. They arrested him, so he's in custody. They ultimately did a photo throwdown. She picked him out again from the photo. This was before DNA. There had been no hospital check on her. There was some vague reference in the police reports that she had made this claim before, but with no specificity. I told my client, don't talk about your case while you're in jail. There's plenty of jail snitches who would love to snitch you out. But of course, most clients do talk, and he did. And he called me up in about 10 days, and he said, Gail, what's the name of that girl again? And I could tell you right now, but I won't. I remember this. And I repeated it, and he said, and he turned around and repeated it to somebody else. And the guy said, yeah, I think that's it. And my client said to me, there's guys back here who swear there was some other black guy who was in here with a similar allegation that some 13-year-old kid just said she had been kidnapped and raped by this guy several weeks prior. We had nowhere else to go with this lead, except to look at other filed indictments. We figured, based on where this girl lived, that these would be Multnomah County cases. So on a whim, I sent my investigator through the clerk's office to you couldn't do elliptical scanning back then either, to just simply read all the indictments. And sure enough, there were not two, There were three other allegations made by this 13-year-old girl that she had been kidnapped and raped by some black male whom she did not know. That became the subject of the defense. Ultimately went to trial. Judge Richard Eunice, later became Justice Eunice, allowed it to be admissible evidence, and he was acquitted. Had we not had access to those other publicly named indictments with this minor victim's name in there, the sole defense available to my client would have been identification. She was misidentifying this black man who had kidnapped and raped her, to which I would say, good luck with that. So this, by enshrining the details on an indictment from public view in other cases, severely impacts the ability of the defense to marshal and get going on other facts as they might be disclosed. With respect to grand jury witnesses, this is, I think, novel. I don't know of any other state law. I haven't seen one that would allow for secrecy with respect to the witnesses who testify before the grand jury. Keep in mind, Oregon already has a lockbox on what goes on in the grand jury. It's not recorded, as this committee well knows. We don't have a clue of what goes on in the grand jury except by the name of the witnesses that appear on the indictment. That is our only clue. And the clue is a big one for us because it can tell us how broad and how narrow of a focus the government is making out of the allegation. But since statehood, and I've submitted written testimony, it has been an obligation since statehood that the names of the witnesses that appeared before the grand jury are stated on the indictment. And that was in an era when everyone did know everyone. And finally, with respect to giving notice to the defense attorney, the purpose of the arraignment is huge. It's what separates the American system of justice from North Korea. You know, when the police arrest somebody, they don't just stay arrested. They have to be brought in front of a court in an open court of law. And the purpose of the arraignment is to give notice to the accused of why they are being detained. People don't submit, they don't commit sex crimes in general terms, they commit them in specific terms. We can see no basis to ever withhold from the defense attorney at the time of arraignment the specifics of the names of the victims and the witnesses who testify before the grand jury. None. And by leaving in the language if good cause is shown, scares us greatly. And there should be no concern about correcting of Scrivener's error. Case law has just been completed. It just came out, State versus Garcia. My goodness. The state was allowed to amend an indictment as to the theory of the crime by interlineation the morning of trial. So there should, without dismissal and without harm. So there's no basis to think that a indictment that contains a Scrivener's error would ever get dismissed. So we see no basis to have any exception but to provide this information to the defense counsel immediate at the time of arraignment. Thank you.
All right, who'd like to go next?
I will.
All right, Sean.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Sean McRae. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in Oregon for 33 years, trying cases all over the state and in federal court. I recently became the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I echo everything that Gail said, and I want to touch on my own situation as a defense lawyer. Dealing first with what Gail said about the overbreadth and not being limited to sex trafficking, while I certainly understand the testimony of the previous witness and her concerns, and not only agree but sympathize and empathize with her concerns for witnesses, victims, and their families, SB 248 will not do what they want it to do. And we need to have the information of the name of the alleged victim, the grand jury witnesses, in order for the defense to appropriately do our job, provide effective assistance of counsel, and actually provide efficiency and economy to the system. Why do I say that? Because when the defense lawyer gets the indictment, when we see who the alleged victim is, when we see who the grand jury witnesses are, we are able then to start doing an investigation into the case. And that makes a difference. And I want to give you an example of a case I had from Lane County last year. A young man and a young woman were involved. There was an allegation of sexual contact. He was then charged with a rape charge, a significant ballot measure 11 offense, which could put him in prison for a number of years, mandatory minimum, over 6 years. When we got the indictment, we looked at it. He didn't know this young woman's last name. He didn't recognize most of the names of the people on the grand jury list. I got an investigator. We began investigating the case immediately. When I got the police reports, the discovery, they indicated that there was no physical evidence in the case. So we were in what often happens in sex cases is we had a he said, she said case. And the critical issue was going to be, one, what made sense in terms of what happened, and number two, credibility. In other words, why would this young woman be making a claim against the young man if it wasn't true? My investigator had already been working on talking to people, on investigating everything that she could regarding the circumstances surrounding this situation. What it ultimately appeared to be was that this young woman was concerned that her boyfriend was going to find out that she had been in a compromising situation. The case was not completed by the time I stepped away from practice and started at OCDLA, but I referred it to another Lane County lawyer. And ultimately, the charges against this young man were dismissed. He didn't go to trial. He didn't end up acquitted. The charges ended up being dismissed. And this was because the defense knew where to start the investigation. There was no harassment of the alleged victim. There was no intimidation of anyone. But we did our homework and we did our work. And the case ended up being dismissed, which was a benefit to the entire system because it saved the court having to conduct a trial, the district attorney having to do further investigation, and in this situation, justice was served. So while I understand the concern, there is also a concern regarding cases like this one where the constitutional rights of the accused are equally important and of concern. And thus, we oppose Senate Bill 248 as it is set up because it takes away an important part of a defendant's right to meet his or her accusers and to be able to do the investigation necessary to be able to have the charges dismissed.
All right. Jim.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name's Jim Gibson. I'm from Klatskanai. I'm a licensed private investigator, have been for the past 9 years, almost 10. Prior to that, I was a reserve deputy for 3 years, starting in 1978, was hired as a deputy sheriff in 1980, and retired after 27 years of paid service. I speak to you from both sides of the picture. I've been there, I've seen both sides. I have a case, or had a case 5 years ago that would be directly impacted if this had been law then. A spouse made false accusations against her husband of rape, kidnapping, and assault. It was a previous case that I was able to find in public records because as a private investigator, we don't have access other than public records. We're not given the same access as law enforcement. I was able to find a previous accusation that she had made of a male acquaintance of hers. Once I started interviewing the witnesses in the previous case, It was determined that she had falsely accused the previous person who had charges dismissed. I wouldn't have had access to those records if this had been law then. It also helped when I had the opportunity to interview the witnesses in the current case I had with the defendant. When talking to those witnesses, they were close acquaintances to the victim. The victim later recanted 3/4 of her claim against the defendant. He ended up being charged with assault 4. They had ultimately, it was determined they both had assaulted each other. She actually was the more serious offender in the assault. He was seriously hurt. She had minor injuries. Where that comes in is if she were to make those same accusations against a future person, unless I was the investigator on the future case, a future investigator would know nothing about. They couldn't get to the records of the case that I handled. I sympathize with victims. I support victims. I'm also on our local public safety coordinating council as a citizen member. I'm very active in the community. I'm an elected member of our fire board and our library board, so I know the consequences of crime. I appreciate Senator Taylor and Representative Huffman for looking out for victims. This goes way too far, including witnesses. I just do not think this is a good legislation because it does erode constitutional rights for future cases unless you have the exact same defense team, which seldom happens. A lot of cases end up in other counties even where you don't have the access to the same counsel. I strongly oppose. I'm a member of our state association. I'm the current treasurer of Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators. We really need to look at the ultimate consequences of this legislation. And I agree, I've looked at other states, and I don't know that any other state that has witnesses included in their list. It's only victims in the other states, to my knowledge. Okay. And I appreciate having the opportunity to come and share from my experience. And I really hope that you do look really seriously. And like I said, I sympathize with victims. I care about victims. But I don't think this law is a good law.
Hey, Jim, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Denbrough first.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, Gail, if we are able to pass the recordation legislation, does that change does it diminish your concern?
Chair Pozanski and Senator Denbrough, in the context of the current case, it would. It would give the defense insight as to what occurred in front of the grand jury. Yes. Right now, of course, we have the names on the indictment are our only clue, and they are big ones.
And a related question. So do you think that there are women who are not reporting sexual assault or, you know, sexual victimization out of concern that the, you know, out of fear of retribution if the names are out there?
Yeah. Chair Pozanski and Senator Denbrough, it's a good question, and I think there's a huge broad spectrum of reasons why people don't come forward to allege sex assault. Some of it is perhaps fear of reprisal, which is what the testimony was. Others of it is just fear of scrutiny, exhaustion, don't want to deal with it. Sometimes women report they just don't like the outcome the criminal justice system has to offer, which is to lock somebody up behind bars. They don't feel that that's the right thing to do. So as to concerns and reprisals, what I haven't quite understood is whether or not any of that really is tethered to the fact that the indictment that's publicly filed contains the name. Clearly, the police reports are going to have people's names. And so it would have to be, I'd have to be convinced that it's because somebody went to the courthouse and saw something on file in the courthouse that then that led to the intimidation. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Thank you. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be very brief. Jim, thank you very much for your comments. I, too, am a former police officer and a former private investigator, so I know about a little bit about probable cause when it comes to criminal activities and how we look at those things. This is a very complex bill right now, and I see it from a larger perspective. One is that I've talked to a mother whose daughter is a victim of sex trafficking. The perpetrator has threatened the mother on several occasions with violence and also threatened the children as well. So I see it from their perspective, and I also see it from a person that may be accused of a crime, and there have been histories of those things going on throughout the time of the United States, where people were just wrongfully accused. Use the situation of African American who was accused of something, and there are others as well that have been accused of crimes that have not found out not to be true. But if you're going through the process and you wind up going through court, that's probably a tag that you have to stay with you for the rest of your life. I just talked with a gentleman that previously has been convicted of a sex crime, and he is now 25 years later, trying to find a job still and a place to stay. My question, since you said that you have access to the police report, then that will certainly give you the names of the victim or all the parties involved, not the investigation, but the allegation of the crime. My question is that when this bill was crafted, have you had the opportunity to sit down and discuss this? I'm also a mediator. So have you had the chance to sit down and talk about this bill to offer your insight, and was it received, or do you think that there might be an opportunity to do that? Because I would like to make sure that we're doing the right thing by the victim, but I also am mindful that in the past there have been a lot of men that have been wrongly accused, and now they're damaged forever as well, and had nothing absolutely to do that, do with any crime like this. But I'm also concerned about the victim. So from this perspective, do you see an opportunity to go and talk with the other side to address those concerns and iron out these differences?
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, with respect to the history of the work group here, initially as it was started by Representative Carolyn Tomei, the defense bar had asked for the opportunity to be present and participate in that work group setting. And we asked repeatedly, and Representative Tomei did not want us and allow us to be present in those work group settings. It's only been this session that I've understood from Senator Taylor. Senator Taylor now has sort of inherited the work group from Representative Tomei's district. Senator Taylor was very surprised to hear that we had been excluded, and she said, "You're certainly not excluded on my watch," and so she has invited us to participate. This bill had already been queued up by the time that we had figured that out. So we haven't had a big sit-down amongst all the stakeholders with respect to this issue. I have shared my concerns with Senator Taylor's office, and again, I think analytically, there's three different things here that really require distinct analysis. The need or the wisdom of having a pseudonym for the victim, the need or the utility of having a pseudonym for the grand jury witnesses, and then access by defense counsel at what time. Those are three different things. And the bottom line is, any effort to further enclose pretrial proceedings in greater secrecy than what we currently have, which is already pretty acute, concerns us because it forecloses avenues of other investigation.
Can I just real quick, the amendments and stuff, are they generally only by the proponents of the bill, or could someone, for example, the defense attorneys, offer an amendment?
Clearly, anyone can offer an amendment. It has to come through, usually comes through a member for it to be drafted and stuff. So those are opportunities and perspectives if someone wanted to try to amend the bill as compared to not amending the bill and just fighting the bill on its own. We have another two panels, so Senator Lipscomb.
I can save my comments. I just have some observations that I think are worth.
I'm going to set a little ground rules here, for just because we have another setting with another three different panels on that. If members can relate, limit your questions to questions, positions, and opposite on observations, let's save those for discussion. So we can actually get through the testimony, because we'd really like to make certain everyone that comes here today has that opportunity. All right, so if there's not any more direct questions, I'm going to ask you all three to step back, please. My next panel is going to be Wayne Gunderson, Ryan Hasted, I believe, and Keith Simpson. And gentlemen, if you've already have written testimony, which I don't think anyone has submitted, but if you do, please don't read it. Just summarize it for us. And if you can keep your statements brief, that would be great, because I have another panel on this bill, and then I have a complete another bill with three other panels on that one. Thank you. So who'd like to go first?
I'll go ahead. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Keith Chipman. I'm with the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I appreciate the opportunity to submit testimony today. I have the pleasure of serving over 250 members of radio and television stations across the state of Oregon. And as members of the media, we serve a vital role serving the public interest, convenience, and necessity in maintaining that social contract between the government and those governed by it. The Oregon Association of Broadcasters is very sympathetic to those victims of sex crimes who are often required to relive their experiences multiple times throughout the trial process. However, our member stations are concerned about the unusually broad nature of Senate Bill 248, particularly the recently released Dash 7 amendments, and that they may adversely impact the public's right to know, particularly if that person involved is a public trustee. The OIB feels that Senate Bill 248 may present substantial First and Sixth Amendment rights issues, particularly those limiting the media's right to report on trial. Under the First Amendment, those press and general public have a constitutional right to access to criminal trials and proceedings. Local radio and television broadcasters serve many roles in the community, the most important of which is a check and balance of the government, local, state, government entities, through their news gathering efforts. And the OAB believes that public records transparency is essential to fulfill that vital role on behalf of Oregon citizens. Unnecessarily broad exemptions, as have been proposed with Senate Bill 248, are in conflict with that objective to provide transparency to the citizens of the state of Oregon. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Keith, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I will. Thank you, Senator Przanski and members of the committee of the Judiciary. My name is Ryan Husted. I'm a licensed private investigator and have been for about 5 years. My prior background is in law enforcement. I am currently on the board of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators, and I'm currently the membership director. I oppose Senate Bill 248. I know that it is common practice for most investigators, including myself, to use public court documents to identify, locate, and interview witnesses. Indictments are an important source of information, and it's a primary function of investigators to discover relationships between individuals. This is a primary way to do it, is through indictments and the names that are listed. Indictments without names would make it nearly impossible for an investigator to know if an individual had made prior allegations with virtually the same testimony in prior cases without the matter reaching trial in open court. It would also make it extremely difficult to locate important witnesses. Thorough investigations rely on our access of information in public court documents and on the presumptive openness of the courts. The scope of Senate Bill 248 will directly impact future investigations in not only criminal but civil and even maybe U visa immigration investigations. The ability of the district attorney's office to employ the legislation at will without any judicial oversight often results in its use as a common practice rather than its use as only when necessary. I believe that if Senate Bill 248 passes into law as it currently exists, even with the Dash 7 amendment, it will greatly damage future investigative efforts in both criminal and civil matters. And I wish to thank the committee for its time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Wayne?
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, my name is Wayne Gunnarsson. I'm a private investigator. I own Gunnarsson Services, and now I'm also with OWALI. I am a board member. And for a story that I feel that you need to be hearing is a young man came out of Las Vegas and tried to restart his life and up here in the Northwest. And he got to know this Caucasian female. And next thing, this African-American male knows that he's up on charges for domestic violence, rape, numerous counts. And while working that case, it came to my attention through the investigation that this woman had charged six men in relatively short periods of time of domestic violence and other charges. And those men were found guilty. However, due to the outstanding investigation that law enforcement had done, it allowed me to have information showing that when she's claiming to have been punched in the face numerous times with a closed fist, well, law enforcement took photos of the man's fists, and they were actually arriving on scene during the incident. And those photos showed 10 Gotti rings, one on each finger of the defendant. And there were no cuts, no severe injury to this woman's face beyond redness. Now, the defendant was claiming that she was punching herself. Now, there's other information that came out that showed that this man did not do what she was claiming. But had we not had the information of the six men prior to this case, it would have made it more difficult for the defense attorney. After we got that not guilty, 2 weeks later, she put another man in jail for the exact same reasons. Having that information out there, I need to be able to get to it. This case that I was working was an indigent case. So in the interest of cost, the more information that's kept from me, the harder I have to work and the more expensive it is for the county or the state. I hope that, well, you clearly understand that I'm against this bill, and I hope that you look at this seriously. Thank you.
All right, Wayne, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
The last individual I have scheduled on the list is Kimberly McCullough. Kimberly, if you can come up and give us your perspective. Is there anyone else who did not sign up for Senate Bill 248 who wanted to give testimony today? And again, we're kind of under a time deadline.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, I have no problem keeping myself very short because I feel like pretty much everything I was going to say has already been said. But I'll just let you know that we do have concerns about the bill. We had greater concerns about it as it was originally drafted. The narrowing in the Dash 7 amendments was certainly helpful, but it doesn't address all of our concerns. Our values really coming to this are around open government and open court. And I'll just list the things that are of concern to us, that this is not limited to victims, that it includes witnesses, that there's no standard that must be met or judicial oversight or any showing of need. And then the delay of giving the information to the defense just implicates due process concerns. So I will leave it at that.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Kimberly? Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248. We're going to open up our last public hearing for the day, which is Senate Bill 385. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 authorizes what's commonly known as motorcycle lane sharing or lane splitting. It allows a motorcycle or moped operator to drive between adjacent lanes of traffic that are traveling in the same direction when certain circumstances are present. The circumstances require that the motorcycle or moped have two wheels and be driven at 20 miles per hour or less on a highway with a speed limit of 50 miles an hour or higher, while traffic is stopped or slowed to a speed of 10 miles an hour or less. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Our first panel is going to be Paula, Patrick, and Brian, pre-selected, so hopefully He will come on up. And while they're getting set, I do have Nick Harris scheduled to give testimony. Nick, where? And you says that you're 100 miles out. Where are you from?
Placerville, California.
Wonderful. We'll get you up.
No running. I got 20 seconds.
Who'd like to? Paula, are you going to start?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Prozanski and members of the committee for letting us bring this bill forward for discussion today. For the record, my name is Paula Leslie. I'm the Executive Director for Bike Pack of Oregon, Inc., PAC number 19. Bike Pack of Oregon represents a Bait of Oregon and all of Oregon's motorcycle riders. We work with legislators and transportation stakeholders to further our mission statement, promoting motorcycle safety, awareness, education, and liberty through legislative action. We're here to request your support for Senate Bill 385, which allows a motorcycle rider to proceed between lanes of traffic during traffic jams and slowdowns under very restrictive conditions. I'm here not only as a bike pack officer, but also as a health professional with personal experience dealing with physical injury, physical and mental fatigue, and mechanical limitations associated with the operation of a motorcycle in stop-and-go traffic. Many motorcycle exhaust pipes put out an enormous amount of heat and at times are positioned in places that could cause burns to the legs and groin area of a rider while their feet are down and the bike is idling for long periods of time. Depending on the air temperature outside and the heat coming up off the pavement, this heat output may also cause the rider to become overheated very quickly, creating a risk for heat stroke. In regard to mental fatigue, motorcycle riders are exposed to the elements, leaving them vulnerable to cold, heat, dehydration, vibration of the bike, wind, constant use of their SIPTI skills, which is basically their situational awareness, poor weather conditions, poor road conditions, heavy highway traffic, frequent and constant gear changes, which all contribute to fatigue of the operator with the absence of sufficient brakes. The outcome of mental and physical fatigue and injury include things like tiredness or cramping in the arms, legs, hand, neck, back, feet, eyes, or the whole body. If you're in a car, you have the opportunity to kind of stretch out a little bit and relieve that. But if you're on a bike, you just have to sit there and wait for it to go away. And then there's one more thing. There's the mechanical risk to the motorcycle engine. Many motorcycles are air-cooled and require constant airflow to keep the engine from overheating, and shutting down your engine on the highway to let it cool down is not an option. There are many benefits of this bill. For Senate Bill 385, it would help to alleviate traffic congestion. It would put riders in charge of their own safety and reduce the risk of serious injury or death due to rear-end collisions. And it reduces the risk of physical injury, mental and physical fatigue of motorcycle riders, as well as reduces the risk of mechanical failure during long periods of engine idling on the highways and interstates. Thank you again, Chair Prozanski, and members of the committee for allowing us to bring this bill forward and your careful consideration of the many aspects of this bill.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Patrick Layshock. I am an Oregon motorcyclist, a board member of the Sangfroid Riding Club, and a former member of the Governor's Committee on Motorcycle Safety. I want to talk to you today about Senate Bill 385 and give you some reasons why you should support it. So first, to reiterate, there are three key circumstances why we're arguing for lane sharing. First circumstance is that this bill applies only to roads where the speed exceeds 50 miles an hour. So we're talking about freeways and interstates. Bill also limits lane splitting to cases where traffic is moving 10 miles an hour or less, and motorcycles are traveling at 20 miles an hour or less. A very simple way I think of that, these are school zone speeds we're talking about. Well, this practice, you can see it right there, motorcyclists proceeding through traffic. It's commonly referred to as lane splitting, lane sharing, or filtering. For our purposes today, they're all the same. This is a common practice worldwide. It's legal in California, and bills very similar to 385 are being considered in a number of other states. Two reasons why I'm asking for your support of 385. The first is that the bill will relieve congestion. And I want to quote here from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, quote, "Lane sharing offers a means of reducing congestion." So this bill will reduce congestion. I also want to point out that this is not a solution in search of a problem. Talk briefly about Portland, Oregon traffic. Portland traffic, as of 2016, was ranked 8th worst in the nation, tied for Washington, D.C. and Chicago. Just 2 years prior, during the 2015 legislative session, Portland was ranked 10th worst. Now it's 8th worst. I've heard the argument, well, traffic's bad in Portland, sure, but it's only bad for a few hours a day. I fully agree with that, but that's exactly the point. Traffic is bad when traffic shouldn't be bad, during commute time. It's when our boss expects us at our desk, we're stuck in traffic. It's when we want to get home to our family and friends that we're stuck in traffic. Economic impact of congestion has been studied very recently, and our governor has referred to traffic and congestion as, quote, mind-numbing congestion that degrades our quality of life. There was a study performed in Belgium a few years ago that modeled the impact of lane sharing on congestion. The upshot of this model was that if 10% of cars switched to motorcycles and lane shared, total time loss for all vehicles, cars and motorcycles, would be decreased by 40%. Every motorcycle or scooter that lane filters is one less vehicle in line, as you can see in the illustration. Fewer vehicles in lines means everyone gets there faster. Now, this is an image I want you to remember. When you're lane sharing, you can simply fit more stuff in an amount of space. You're more efficiently utilizing existing transportation infrastructure. The Belgian study also showed an ancillary benefit, and that was actually a reduction in emissions. One reason that emissions are reduced is simply because vehicles spend less time idling in traffic. Another is that motorcycles are much more fuel efficient than automobiles. The second reason I'm arguing for Senate Bill 385 and asking for your support is that the bill will make motorcyclists safer. Now, motorcyclists, just like car drivers, get in accidents. In the case of motorcycling, there's a way to reduce harm to riders, reduce the severity of injuries. There was a study I submitted, it's part of my written testimony. This study was instrumental in codifying the California legislators' lane sharing bill last year. The study was commissioned by the California Office of Traffic Safety, performed by researchers at UC Berkeley. Now, this is not a study of Europe or Indonesia, this is a study of a neighboring state. It's relevant. CHP collected data for over 1,000 accident scenes, and it separated those accident victims into two groups, riders who were lane sharing and riders who were not lane sharing. The question they asked was, which group, the lane sharing riders or the riders who were not, which group was less likely to get injured? What was the safer group? The study conclusively showed, and supported by the evidence, that lane sharing riders are less likely to suffer injury or fatality. And again, this is another image I want you to remember. The blue riders are the group that were lane sharing. Red riders were not lane sharing. And you can see that the prevalence of fatal injury, head injury, and torso injury was much less when a rider was lane sharing. Now, if you're a rider, this makes complete sense, and Brian's going to touch on the reasons why. Chris Cochran from the California Office of Traffic Safety, quote, "What we learned from this study is if you lane split in a safe or prudent manner, it is no more dangerous than motorcycling in any other circumstance." The study also shows that lane sharing at low speeds, such as the speeds proposed by this bill is safer yet. So I've shared with you two reasons I'm asking for your support of Senate Bill 385. The bill will relieve congestion and it will make motorcyclists safer. A third reason, inertia is growing in support of lane sharing nationwide. A later member will speak to this, but I truly think this is an opportunity for Oregon to be a national leader. Thank you.
Thank you. And that leaves us with Brian.
Yep.
And Brian, if you submit a testimony, please don't read it in the record.
No, I have a PowerPoint I wanted to.
All right, how long is your PowerPoint? Just so
it's like six slides.
That'd be great.
I don't think we want to update. Go full screen. There we go.
Okay. So, Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Brian Edwards, and I'm a public relations professional. I've been practicing in Oregon for over 20 years, and I'm also a former Team Oregon instructor, and I'm an avid motorcyclist. So that's really the three reasons I'm here, is to share a little bit of my background as a Team Oregon instructor and why I think this makes a lot of sense, safe lane sharing, and then also to just touch a little bit on some of the public awareness, rider training, and making the public aware of it. So, first thing I wanted to do is to share a quote with you. This is from Bill Quirk, who's one of the co-sponsors of the successful effort to legalize lane splitting in California that passed last year. And so one of his rationale behind this is there's a safe way to do it and an unsafe way to do it. Most notably, it allows motorcyclists to drive defensively in congested traffic to avoid being rear-ended. However, lack of information on how it should be done safely means different people lane split under safe conditions while others lane split at high speeds with a little regard for safety. Now, this was a critical problem in California because it was not covered legislatively, and so there was no information on how to lane split in a safe manner. It was just not prohibited. So we don't have that same problem here necessarily, but I mean, obviously there are people that will get out there and lane split, and they're not aware of how to do it. But I think the bigger problem is what I'll touch about now, is that basically when riders are taught and they go through a Team Oregon school, they're taught, okay, ride defensively, always check your mirror, look to your sides, and always be thinking about an escape route. So that means that in this case, if you look at the rider, he has no escape route because he's completely boxed in. And this is a common situation that you're going to face in any congested area on a highway where the speeds are 50 miles an hour or more. Traffic comes to a halt. You know, you're slowing down, you're looking behind your mirrors, you see a guy coming up on you, you have literally nowhere to go. So what we see happening, what we'd like to be able to teach is part of the Team Oregon curriculum would be, okay, so when you're going in a congested situation, there is an escape route to you to the left or to the right of the car, and more to the point, you could actually defensively and proactively say, I see traffic slowing down, I'm going to put myself in a position where I'm going to be able to go between the lanes. I won't have to worry about somebody coming up behind me. So it takes you out of a, you know, wait and see attitude, hope nobody hits you, to I'm defensively taking an action. So that's just one example, and I believe that, you know, the Team Oregon instruction program is probably one of the finest in the country. And those instructors would be very capable of teaching riders how to lane split in a very safe and prudent manner. So switching gears a little bit, if SB 385 were to become law, what would happen? What would be the public example? How would we get the word out? And so here's an example of a municipality in New Zealand that legalized lane splitting in 2014. And so They have very similar constraints to SB 385, and they drove a lot of news coverage. They set up some websites. They put some videos. I won't play the video, but they produced a very nice video that talked about why lane filtering was safer and made sense for motorcyclists. In our case, we were very successful after in 2015 when this legislation, very similar legislation, came up earlier. After that passed the Senate, we talked to the Oregonian, we talked to Coin6 and KGW and some other outlets, and we got a very nice round of coverage. So, and this is an issue that affects everybody, so the news stations are very interested in covering it. So I believe that this time around, if this were to pass and become law, there would be 3 to 4 rounds of coverage. So when it passes the Senate, passes the House, gets signed, actually gets implemented, there'd be quite a bit of coverage about it, and that would get the word out to all the drivers out there that, okay, motorcycles can now lane split between us. And I think a key aspect of all this is that the drivers don't have to do anything. They don't have to change their behavior. They just have to not freak out when a motorcycle comes between them, maybe check their mirrors, don't open their car door in the middle of traffic, some things like that. But from a driver's standpoint, they just need to be aware that motorcycles can now do this. And lastly, this is a just an example of what happened in 2015 with the article where lane splitting was presented as a very, in a safe way. It's not guys ripping between lines. It's people 20 miles an hour, school zone speeds. So when those facts get out there and they see that this is about improving rider safety, helping to reduce rear end accidents, when that type of information gets out there, the public reacts in a favorable way. So this is clearly not a scientific study, but it does indicate that 81.61% of people who read about safe lanes filtering thought it was a pretty good idea. And so just to wrap up, I just feel like time is right. As Patrick was saying, traffic problems are getting worse. Lane filtering actually improves rider safety because it allows us to drive defensively. The readers, if it's safe lane splitting, there'll be public support behind it. And speaking for myself and other members of the motorcycling committee, we're going to work really hard if this passes to educate our fellow riders and fellow citizens about how what the restrictions are, what the requirements are, what safe lane filtering or lane splitting, lane sharing, what it really means. So thank you very much for your time.
All right. Brian, thank you very much. Any questions for anyone on this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. All right, so we're going to do a time check here. I've got about 15 minutes before the hour of 10. Our committee actually ends right now. I may have members leaving. I'm going to take additional testimony at this time. But with that said, hang on, guys. I'm going to take Nick Harris first because he's over 100 miles out. So, Nick, come on up and take your, give me your testimony. And if Ramsey, Rami Strout, why don't you come up, too? That will give us two people here, and then we'll have another panel. And then I've got one after that. Nick, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Sure. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski, Chairman Brzezinski, and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Nick Harris. I'm the Western States Representative for the American Motorcyclist Association. I came up from California. I'm very involved in Assembly Bill 51, which was passed. I worked closely with Assemblymember Quirk and Assemblymember Lackey, who are the authors of that bill. And I'm actually on the California Motorcycle Safety Program Advisory Committee, and we have a subcommittee meeting tomorrow in Sacramento to further discuss the lane splitting guidelines. I've submitted testimony. I don't want to take up a ton of the committee's time, but basically I wanted to point out there's 11 states currently considering lane splitting legislation. Oregon is one of them, and I think this bill is a great first step. It really opens it up without opening it up everywhere. You know, in California, we've obviously done this for many years. I personally lane split, I won't say every time I ride, but nearly every time I ride. It's a very accepted practice. I've experienced the kind of joys of lane splitting in other countries. Once it becomes a normal thing that drivers, that riders are used to, some of the examples we saw today, it's just not an issue. And it's kind of, I realize for some people it's kind of a change in idea or in perspective, but you know, if you go to Europe or you go to Australia, people wave you by, you know, drivers know it, riders know it, and the key is getting the information out. And I think, like I say, this is a great way to do it. It controls where you're going to do it, and I think the speeds are very reasonable, and I request your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Rami?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rami Stroud. I'm the former state director of fire service training for Oregon and had the opportunity to work with fire departments, both professional and volunteer, all over the state. Prior to that, I was a captain with the L.A. City Fire Department, and during the course of my career in L.A., I responded to approximately 10,000 different alarms. I was in the L.A. Civic Center, and a lot of those alarms were related to motor vehicle accidents on the freeways. So I come to Oregon, and the local fire departments are asking me to develop training programs that they need. One of those training programs was related to motor vehicle accidents. So in doing the research for these accidents, what do firefighters need, we're looking at motorcycle accidents. And we do sort of a triage, just like the medical profession, only the nature of the incident. Number one worst accident was where the motorcycle would impact a fixed object, like a bridge abutment, or if a car pulled out in front of them, the motorcycle T-bones a car. Number two worst was a rear-end accident. And most of the time, the motorcycle would be stopped in traffic, hit from behind, and if the rider had a passenger, then the passenger was going to take the hit first, and that her head, most of the time it was a woman, would be snapped back, and there would be some severe cervical injuries, either soft tissues or the cervical vertebrae would be fractured or even a spinal cord injury. And eventually she would hit the passenger, or the driver, and then his head would be snapped back. And the same problem, except the back of his helmet would hit her in the face. And then if the car had velocity to be able to push the bike, the rider, and the passenger into the car in front, then there would be compression problems. And so we spent a lot of time looking at how fire departments were going to be able to handle these, because it's tough for volunteer firefighters to be able to deal with those kinds of injuries. And for me, it was surprising, because I hadn't experienced these kinds of injuries and accidents in California. And I was trying to figure out, why is it that I'm having to deal with this in Oregon when I didn't in California? The reason is, ultimately we figured out, is that in California, the motorcycles get out of the way. They were allowed to be able to filter through traffic and stop and go low speed situations, where in Oregon they weren't. It was against the law. So I'm trying to give you a little bit of personal perspective from the fire idea, and I have other testimony, but I understand you're very busy today, so I'll submit written testimony if that would be okay with.
That would be great. Yeah, written testimony here. We're not doing anything with the bill today. We're just taking public testimony. I'm going to actually have to carry some of that over. Senator Dimbrough.
Yeah, I just have a quick technical question. So trying to envision how it works in California. Sometimes the gap between two adjacent cars is pretty narrow. Are people, you know, kind of moving out of the way if they see that a motorcyclist is coming?
I'm sorry?
You want to answer?
Oh, certainly. My experience is, and I've spent a lot of time with a fellow with CHP officers and so on, and doing field investigations at the accidents, I had to fill out all the reports, and that the motorcycle riders are making a determination based on their situational awareness, is this a reasonable place to go? And like if there were trucks that were close together, then they don't go there. So they're making good decisions, but in this situation, it's very slow speed, 10 miles an hour or so for traffic, 20 miles an hour, which means a differential of 10. And so they've got plenty of time to decide whether that's a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, just to follow up, I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of the behavior of the people in the
sure.
four-wheel vehicle.
I'd be happy to answer it. I actually was lane splitting in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago in rush hour on a Goldwing, which is a pretty large bike. And I'd say, by and large, you see a lot of people. Now, admittedly, they can't move over 5 feet, but you see people in their mirrors. You know, there's kind of an understanding and awareness that I've experienced. And occasionally, frankly, you see someone from out of state that doesn't necessarily know what's going on. But overall, I'd say a lot of times I see people. And then there's a guy who has the shoulder that'll pull half off, and I assume that's a fellow rider. But, yeah, you do definitely see a lot of recognition. And, you know, as long as you're driving reasonably and you're not honking the horn or anything, you know, there seems to be a very kind of a understanding of the situation.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to ask you to step back.
Thank you very much.
here's where we're at right now. I have another panel that was pre-selected to give testimony on the proponents. Then I have four individuals that look to me like they could come back tomorrow. For those three here, Christopher, Dwight, and Jessica, I'm going to give you your choice because you're going to only have like a minute, minute and a half right now to give testimony if you want to give testimony today, or you can come back tomorrow and we can do it first thing in the morning at 8 o'clock.
Senator Brzezinski, I know that at least one of my clients will not be available tomorrow.
We'll take their
testimony.
All right, we'll take whoever's testimony now that can't be here tomorrow. And then for those that are opponents, it looks like everyone here on the list are, let's say, regulars, and they can come back, I hope, tomorrow. We'll work for your schedule. All right, so we're going to have to hang on here for a second. Regarding another PowerPoint presentation, how much time are we talking about?
Just a photograph in my testimony, sir.
And colleagues, if you do need to leave, feel free to leave.
Chairman Brzezinski, committee, thank you for this. On June 30th, 2015.
Your name?
Dwight Gibbons, Florence, Oregon.
Thank you.
On June 30th, 2015, I was riding my motorcycle in Portland, Oregon. Stopped in line at a metered traffic on-ramp, Alberta on-ramp, getting on I-5 North. I was behind three or four cars, which were stopped at the light. Without any warning, I was suddenly struck from behind with a car that so much force, it pushed both me and my motorcycle under the car in front of me. The car continued to drive on and struck a barrier wall down the ramp. So I was actually underneath the white car there, and he hit me with enough force to shove me. I was up between the front and rear seat, and the car that hit me was actually the one up there up against the wall. And so he hit me with enough force, made it around that car somehow, I have no idea, and broke his front axle. So it was quite a hit. And I was trapped underneath the running car, suffered burns to my face and body. My mouth was tore open, tooth breaking, had a fractured vertebrae, fractured hips, pelvis, ribs, bruised lung, lacerated liver, multiple cuts and abrasions from my toes to my head there. You know, and this accident just changed my life forever. It's done just a bad thing for me. And the driver of the car denied, of course, he was on his cell phone or whatever, but nevertheless, he was reckless. You know, I've always thought he just must not have been paying attention because of the location and everything. I didn't understand how he could have been doing what he was doing. So my accident could have happened about another 30 yards ahead of me. I would have been right on I-5 in the congested traffic. And you guys really do have a bunch of congested traffic up there in Portland. And sitting behind cars stopped in traffic, you know, gives riders the option filtering between the lanes and stuff. Would help prevent things such as myself, because if even you could filter behind the lanes, even though I was on the on-ramp, and it's not the law to just sit behind a car, and I always kind of off to the side as an easy out anyway, I would have definitely been up the side of that car or whatever had you and not been in that position to be rear-ended. And so I can tell you from personal experience, I'd rather have a car change lanes in front of me without looking or this or that than to rear-end me from behind, because it's not fun. I'm still going through, you know, I'll be going through treatment for the rest of my life probably from this. So that's my testimony. I really support the bill, and I hope you do too.
All right, Dwight, thank you for your testimony. And you must be Jessica.
Yes. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Naylor. I'm an avid motorcyclist. I used to commute daily on a motorcycle. I did not own a car. I lead a very active lifestyle, including working 50 hours a week as a chef in a professional kitchen, bicycling, motorcycling, kickboxing, mixed martial arts. I used to do all of these things. 3.5 months ago, on Monday, November 28th at 1:42 p.m., a very nice day, I was commuting on my motorcycle wearing a high visibility yellow safety vest. I was approaching an intersection in my neighborhood, heading eastbound on Fremont Street in Portland,
and preparing to make a right turn at the intersection on Northeast 57th. The light was green, and I put on my right blinker and reduced my speed by half. About 50 feet from the intersection, I was preparing for my turn-in point, a visual marker ahead where I will turn the bike. At this moment, I was thrust from behind into the air. I saw the sky and the power lines, and I did not know what was happening to me. My bike and I landed in the middle of the intersection. Witnesses have informed me that the SUV behind me did not hit the brakes before impact, and I was ejected from my bike upwards and fell on my right side onto the ground. The rear wheel of my motorcycle landed on my right ankle, and my helmet hit the ground, and my knuckle armor on my gloves was chewed up. I went to the ER and was diagnosed with a badly broken ankle that required surgery and whiplash all the way around my neck. 15 days before my accident, my boyfriend, an avid motorcyclist, was also struck from behind on the Lombard exit ramp on the I-5 North in Portland at a stop sign. He was completely stopped, and situational awareness involved, he saw behind him in his mirrors that the truck was not stopping. His choice was to filter out to the side in order to escape. He was not as brutally injured, nor did he drop the bike like I did, because he was escaping and was hit from the side. Every time I get on a motorcycle, I wear fully armored, top quality safety gear from head to toe. No matter how short the trip, I believe in my safety and the safety of others. Being on a motorcycle puts riders in a more vulnerable position, which requires us to pay more attention for our safety. The reason I wear a high visibility yellow safety vest or a one-piece yellow rain suit is because I want to be seen. I want to be safe. I provide myself with the highest level of safety and visibility that I can. But what can I do if drivers are not looking at the scene in their windshield? Several times a week, I have moments where cars turn in front of me anyway, and I'm watching, and I'm ready to swerve myself to safety. But finally, I had a day where the inattentive, reckless driver came at me from behind and caught me in a position where I could not escape. Being on a motorcycle, I have the maneuverability and the power to escape from these situations. However, I'm not legally allowed to. Yesterday, I had my first motorcycle ride since the accident. It was a beautiful day. But the only thing that terrified me was not being on a motorcycle. I felt very confident in my riding skills. What scared me and terrified me was the minivan behind me that followed me for three lights and every time pulled up too close behind me. I pulled my bike pretty far back away from the car in front of me, got the minivan behind me to stop, and then I would scoot up a little more and the van would follow me again and be too close behind me. I had to wave her to back off. My plan of escape was to filter if a wreck were to happen behind me. Riders like me need to have the most safety options available whenever we ride so that we have the best opportunity to avoid a rear-end accident like mine. On highways and freeways during commuting hours, that means allowing riders like me to safely filter between lanes of slowed or stopped traffic so we are not just sitting there exposed to being rear-ended by inattentive, reckless drivers. While I think that this practice would help reduce traffic congestion for everyone, I want it more for the safety after my recent accident. I hope that you will recommend passage of SB 385 for me and my fellow riders.
All right, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you all very much for coming forward and giving your testimony. All right, so this is what's going to happen. For those who are signed up to give testimony, we'll continue that testimony tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. The people I have down here that will be back for their testimony only is Joe Elliott, Christopher Slater, Bob Russell, Marie Dobbs, Troy Costas. I always say it wrong. Sorry. All right, so that's who's going to be back. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing for today. We are carrying this public hearing over for the testimony of those five individuals. With that, we're adjourned for the day. For the day.